Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The violence out of Iraq may be down, but daily life for the average Iraqi is still backbreaking and heartbreaking. It's about skirting militiamen and young American and British soldiers armed to the teeth who don't always understand you or like you. You need to be planning for your children's college education, but you're hawking your living room furniture and scrounging up gas for your car. And that's if you're lucky. This hour on Point, the facts of daily life for the civilians of Iraq. And joining me now in the studio is Sarah Sewell. She's director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She's an expert on the use of force in counterinsurgency wars and especially the impact on civilians. And joining us from Detroit is Dr. Najib Hamnouni. He himself is an Iraqi civilian, an ophthalmologist who once had a successful practice in the Sadoun district of the city. He arrived in this country 2 weeks ago. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for joining us on Point. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
And welcome, Dr. Najib Hamnouni. Can you hear me?
Thank you, Jackie. I hear you excellent.
All right. Thank you for being with us. Sarah Sewell, I'd like to come to you first. You are also known for writing the foreword to the published report of General Petraeus' new counterinsurgency manual. And you have looked at the impact on civilians since the beginning of this. I'd like to ask you, do you think that in the forward planning for the war, there was ever an emphasis or a thought that the Iraqi civilian should be at the center of the campaign? I believe you have said the center of gravity when it comes to thinking about the impact of this war.
Well, it's odd, Jackie. You know, I think the reports reveal that the president and his inner circle thought this would be a humane war because they would target the Iraqi leadership and fight with this small footprint with discriminate force and leave the civilian unscathed. And to the extent that they thought about the civilian at all, it was in the form of refugees or humanitarian assistance and the meals ready to eat packages they would have to send out. But they didn't do any post-war planning. They didn't put the civilian at the heart of their operational construct. And, you know, when they got into Iraq and they began to encounter the kinds of tactics that really upended their assumptions about this war, and not just whether they'd be greeted with open arms, but how the enemy would fight and how they would in turn have to fight the enemy. As General Wallace now famously said, this was not the enemy we war gamed against. And they were just grossly unprepared for what they found. And in many ways, the history of this war has been America coming to terms with the centrality of the civilian and the need to upend the American way of war to respect that changed environment.
Well, let's speak to an Iraqi civilian. Dr. Najib,
yes.
You have arrived in this country just a few weeks ago. You came on November the 14th.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit. I do want to say that you and I have a prior relationship. We met in Baghdad in 2003, and we have been in touch ever since, and I have known you over the years there. I'd like for you, though, to tell your story. Your initial contact with American soldiers was actually quite positive.
It was absolutely excellent. It was fascinating.
What happened?
And what happened is that we used to live in a neighborhood where next to my own house there was one of Saddam's, you know, major police entities, intelligence entities. When the war was going, you see, we left home, which was near this intelligence
in Mansour office. This was in the Mansour district.
Mm-hmm. In Mansour district, and we fled to my son's house, who is in the other pole of the city, on the other side of the city, because we thought it would have been a little bit safer. Towards the end, we came back to our house. The whole part of the whole war was only 20 days. We came at the end of the major hostilities, and next door to ours, there was, in one of the houses, which used to be part of the intelligence offices, Saddam's intelligence offices, there was at least a few tons of ammunition and bombs and all sorts of deadly material, you see, next door. One of our girls, my daughter, and one of the girls in the neighborhood went and fetched two Humvees and brought the Americans, and they said, the Americans said, don't let anybody come into here, and we're going to clean this tomorrow. They came tomorrow, and during the middle of the tomorrow, next day, there were four very nice, very interesting, very, you know, very respectable four people in military. They were standing at the outer side of the door, you see, at the entrance of the door of the house, and they said, can we come in?
So they asked you, if you would have them in.
That's right. They said, Dr. Hanoudi, can we get into here? I said, I never seen them before. I didn't know who they were, in fact. I'm still not able to say the rank of a soldier, you see, or a general from his gear.
You see. But eventually you became very close to this unit. Can you tell
eventually
us
Eventually became extremely, extremely, extremely friendly, and we are still very, very friendly and on extremely, you know, nice and very genuine relationship. We call each other brothers, and they have been through the years, which were years of you know, agony and pain to us, at least, as a family. And if I might have time, I'll be telling you a little bit later on what was the nature of the tragedy
And we will get to that. But I wanted to ask you, this group of soldiers, they were known as the Desert Rogues. Tell us which battalion they were?
They were part of the 3rd Infantry, a task force which was led by a very nice, a very kind, and extremely intelligent and efficient, you know, lieutenant colonel. And these were the people who were the first to come into Baghdad.
But I'd like to ask you and Sarah Sewell, you were able to speak English with these people. You have been educated. You did your postdoctorate at Oxford University in England. There was a sort of professional level at which you were able to talk to them. Most of your patients, for example, couldn't have had that conversation. Sarah Sewell, how many interpreters, for example, were with U.S. forces as they went into these neighborhoods?
Interpreters have been in chronic short supply, and even though the U.S. has recognized that the inability to communicate with the local population whose security you're in charge of is a huge disadvantage, we've simply not been able to procure adequate numbers. And this relates to a broader issue of sort of cultural awareness and appreciation of the environment in which they were operating. You know, it took the U.S. years to recognize that it was actually very important to understand what the hand signal for stop meant in an Iraqi context, because it's different from the way we do it here at home.
In fact, it's just the opposite.
In fact,
what
it's
we
just
say
the
stop
opposite.
Means go to them.
And the notion that all of your different units should be operating checkpoints in a similar way so that Iraqis know what to do when they're in different neighborhoods and they can have a certain degree of predictability in their interactions with the American and coalition forces. You know, these were seem self-evident to us now, but they were part of a learning curve at the time.
Mm-hmm. And Najib, I would like to say that we will come to what becomes a more tragic part of your story after our break, but in the few minutes that we have remaining in this portion of our show, what did your patients tell you and your colleagues as you were gaining trust with these Americans? Was that the same experience for your friends and neighbors?
Jackie, if I might go back to what we started, I mean, this talk with what our colleague was saying about the preparation or the non-preparation by the American administration when they came into Iraq. What happened when they came into Iraq was they promised us that they were going to get us rid of Saddam, which they did brilliantly and in a very short time. They have also promised us during the preparation phase that after they will be getting us rid of Saddam, they are going to help us reconstruct the country. And I had always the impression that the Americans would be instituting something of a Marshall Plan to rejuvenate and reconstruct the country. But that didn't happen. And when the people started to feel, to understand that that was not going to happen, faith started to dwindle. I can even say that the respect to the American promises started to get, you know, to get to almost zero levels. I myself was absolutely 100% with the American move into Iraq. But when I discovered that the promises to reconstruct, the last few days of Saddam were terrible. There was massive destruction. The country was in ruin. And we were promised that our friends, the Americans, who were coming to get us rid of Saddam, would also, after they would be finishing with Saddam, they would be helping us to reconstruct the country. There has been absolutely no reconstruction of the country. And this failure, forgive me to say that, I mean, I hope people would understand me, you see. I'm not being pejorative. I'm only trying to explain what really happened.
Right, and we're going to continue on that in the next part of our show, because, in fact, you became a refugee.
That's right. In the end, the poison situation, the failure of the promises, the rise of the insurgency, the war which is going, which is a double war, you see, a triple
we
war.
Will come into, we will war. Come back to that. We will come back to that. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about being a civilian in Iraq today. 4.5 years into the American occupation and the Civil War, and more than 9 months into the surge. My guests are Dr. Najib Hanoudi, an Iraqi ophthalmologist who's just arrived in this country, and Sarah Sewell, director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and an expert on the impact of the use of force on civilian populations. We were listening to Dr. Najib's story, Sarah, just before our break. And Najib, I'd like you to continue it. After this initial positive year with the U.S. military, a tragedy occurred in your family. Can you just outline it as briefly as possible? What happened?
We got on extremely very, very good terms with the people, the American military, during the first 6 weeks, 6 months post-war, post the major hostilities. And we are still, and I am still, on very, very good terms with most of them. We call each other brother. We are very good friends. They care about us. They have always been very careful and helpful and kind during this tragedy. Mm-hmm. The Hanoudi tragedy occurred on the 29th of March, 2004, when my son, who was working as a minor contractor to a small unit which belonged to the first, now to the first,
the first infantry.
The first.
A different unit, though. Not the people you were familiar with.
It's not the same unit. And he was working for them. He was on extremely good terms with them. He was very friendly with them. He used to go in and out of the camp without anybody asking about anything. On that fateful day, the 29th, he was trying to get into the camp, taking a small, mechanical instrument to do some repair jobs to the there. They said, we have warned him because he was coming towards the camp in a hurry. And we shot a warning one, which he didn't heed. And then we had to shoot another one, which went through the door, the driver's side of the car, and went through his left loin, ruptured his kidney, destroyed some of the soft tissues in his abdomen. That happened at 10 in the morning, 10:30 in the morning. During the night, the wound bled, and they redeployed him, or they took him as an emergency to what's called the 31st Cache Hospital, the first American.
And this is the American Field Hospital in the Green
Field
Zone.
Field Hospital in Baghdad, which was, in the old days, the elite hospital to Saddam. They used to call it Ben Sina Hospital, and that was during Saddam, is an elite hospital. It was serving Saddam and his family only.
Mm-hmm.
And Nizar was taken to that hospital. He had lots of operations. There were many complications. There was a major failure, a catastrophic attempt by one of our hospitals in Baghdad, when he was sent there to have a hemodialysis. And the hemodialysis, which was done in our hospital, in the Baghdadi hospital, was a catastrophe. It ended by having the boy having his heart arrested, and was sent back to the American hospital. The cardiac arrest was reversed. He was beating again, but that happened after 14 minutes of non-oxygenation or non-feeding to the brain.
So your son, who's in his mid-30s, today is in a vegetative state.
And that was what sent him into what now called a vegetative state. Incidentally, Jackie, I'm not very happy with the vegetative terminology. Nowadays, they are calling it a subminimal case. I mean, a minimal subconscious case.
State. I apologize. I was trying to.
No, you don't have to apologize. We were told in the beginning, we were told that this is clinical death, which was a horrible definition. They were a little bit kinder in their teaching to us as very young, you know, as very young students. Later on, they started to call it vegetative state. Still, vegetative state is a terrible term. Now it's becoming a little bit more humane now, and they are calling it a minimal conscious state, which is fine and nice, because these people, Jackie, these people who are called clinical dead, clinically dead, or vegetative state are not dead. They are as alive as I am, you see.
Well, but your focus, of course, over the last...
It's a bit of a lower status.
Your focus, Najib, over the last 4 years has very much been your family and your son. But perhaps you could tell us about what happened to your practice, your neighborhood. The neighbors had to flee. Your old neighborhood, Mansour, has now been taken over by insurgents. What happened to your family?
We had, after a year and a half of taking care to the injured boy in Baghdad, we were forced to take him to Amman for different reasons. Things were getting bad and more bad and more bad and more bad regarding everything in Baghdad. Security was deteriorating. The provision of supplies was no electricity, no water, no nothing. And the boy was in a very critical case, in a critical clinical situation. So we had to take him to Amman, which was a big adventure, which was a very costly adventure. But during that adventure and during that mayhem, we were helped tremendously, unexpectedly by very, very kind and very benevolent people, you see. And they were helping with words, with money, with everything. And to make things even more, you know, more
And these
charitable.
Were other Iraqis who were helping you?
Oh, they were Iraqis and were there no Iraqis.
No Iraqis?
Yeah, there were people from Japan, from Africa, from who have heard about the story, which I am always telling to the world through a website I have, a blog, you call it here in this country, onto which I write some of my wisdom, you see, on that. And my, good heavens. And very often I insert pieces about the progress of the case, the situation of Nizar, what's happening to him. It's been a kind of a catharsis. I mean, it's been a kind of a treatment, a psychological treatment. But going back to what's going on in Iraq, I left back to Baghdad a year and a half ago to go back and do some work, because this taking care of Nizar has been a tremendous strain on our financial resources.
So you were able to return to your practice in Baghdad worked under
and
fire.
I did, because after 50 years of medicine and with this tragedy, I was almost having no more than a few dollars in my pocket. So I had to go to Baghdad and practice. And it was amazing. It was amazing in two respects, because when I went back, most of the good ones, the good doctors, the experienced ones, the not very young ones, the older generations have all fled the country. And at time, I was the only old functioning ophthalmologist in the whole country. I mean, I don't think you would believe that, or you can imagine it. In a city of 5 million, there was only one capable ophthalmologist, which was me.
I don't know if we can quantify it, nor do I know if I can imagine it. I also recall a colleague of yours, a psychiatrist, who was one of the last of 50 and the day that he left. Let's bring in another of our guests today. We're also speaking with Christelle Yunis, and she's an analyst and advocate with the nonprofit organization Refugees International. Welcome to the show, Christelle.
Thank you for having me, Jackie.
You're joining us from Washington, D.C., I believe.
Yes.
I know that you have looked at the internal displacement of Iraqis. We all know that more than 2 million people have fled over the borders. What can you tell us about what has happened inside of Iraq?
Well, people have been fleeing both across the borders but also within Iraq. The numbers within Iraq are equally great as the ones outside of the country. There are now almost 2.5 million Iraqis who have been displaced within Iraq, more than 1.5 million since February 2006, the Samarra bombings. The people who are staying inside the country are often the most vulnerable, those who cannot afford crossing an international border. And now, as international borders have indeed mostly closed around Iraq, most people cannot leave the country anymore and are forced to flee internally.
Dr. Najib talked a moment ago about having to come back to work. Do you see other Iraqis? We have heard that 25,000 or so, which is, remember, the population of the country was 26 million. Do you see many people coming back to work?
Absolutely not. And the reality is that the vast majority of those who have returned to Iraq have returned because they can no longer afford staying outside of the country for lack of resources, but also because of visa restrictions. According to the UN, it's only 14% of those who return from Syria who return because security improved. The rest of them return because they had no other choice.
And Sarah Sewell, when you have listened to Najib Hanoudi's story, how does this change the dynamic? Obviously, there are going to be civilian casualties. There are going to be civilian deaths. But in this particular case, you mentioned the general who said this was not the enemy we prepared for. And, of course, insurgents blend among the civilian population. You can't tell who's hostile and who isn't. But you have written a lot, including in your opening to the Petraeus report, about what this change has meant.
I think one of the principles in the new counterinsurgency field manual is that you don't want to use military force if in trying to kill one enemy you're creating 10 others. And I think what I'm really struck by listening to Najib's story is that Tolstoy quote about how all happy families are alike, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. I think that speaks to much of Iraq, unfortunately, at this point. And it comes from the naive assumptions and lack of preparedness for what would happen after we removed Saddam. It comes from a conventional military force that was entirely unprepared to fight an unconventional foe in a way that didn't ultimately transfer the costs and risks to the civilians in the nation that they were nominally liberating. It comes from a host of mistakes and acts of omission that play out in this story that Najib told us. And the bottom line is that if you are in a situation in which you are inflating expectations and causing inadvertent harm and alienating the very people whose allegiance you need to provide any nominal victory in a sense that you can share, then you're not going to be successful. And a lot of the learning curve really for the United States military in particular, since it recognized finally that they had, by virtue of eliminating the infrastructure of this country, allowing a huge period of a security vacuum, a whole host of decisions that they had made, and the fact that they didn't have enough forces on the ground to provide that basic security for Iraqi civilians, sort of realized the mess that they were in and began to try to unpack the principles that they needed to follow in order to work their way out of this and change the situation. And among those is this notion of the civilian as the center of gravity, the goal not being protecting yourself, but instead protecting the other. The notion that the use of force has to be restrained, the notion that the political elements in this larger campaign are as important as any military elements, and that the pieces of education and health and political reform at the local levels are ultimately essential, but that security needs to be guaranteed first.
Let's go to a phone call. We're hearing now from Assad, who is calling from Middletown, Connecticut. Welcome to the show, Assad.
Hi, thank you, Jackie.
What is your question or comment this morning, Assad? Could you share it with us?
Actually, the only information I get is through my parents once in a while. I talk to them. They live in Baghdad. For the last 4 years, almost 5 years, I don't hear anything positive. All I hear is negative stuff. And my parents are very, most of the time they try to be very positive. But
have they had to move from one house to another?
I would love to do that. They can't. They can't go anywhere, actually. My sister lives on the other side of Baghdad in Al-Mansour, and they kind of cut off for the last 5-6 months, and no telephones. So they really, if they're lucky, they can talk to her, and she's very sick. And that's every time I ask them, so what's going on with my sister, and how is she feeling? Well, a little bit better. Called us last month. We had a chance to talk to her, and I don't know if you know, but there are really no telephone lines. So,
well, when you said she called last month, I assume that it wasn't easy for her to telephone.
It wasn't actually easy to talk, Herbert. But I guess things are a little bit better. But in terms of as a family, they can't see her. They can't go. They can't visit. I mean, electricity, the same thing, 2-3 hours, water. I mean, it's a disaster. That's all I hear.
Okay, Assad, let me ask you, we only have a couple of minutes before our break. Do you have a sense that people ever get a chance to consider whether or not this was worth it, or is daily life so grim that they're just thinking about getting through the next hour?
Absolutely. You know, when I talk, I'm not going to say his name. It doesn't matter. It was a famous, very famous civil engineer in Iraq, and he's a very positive person, always in terms of, you know, things going to be better, Assad, don't worry, and he's still the same. But my mom is actually the one who tells me the truth, and she said, Assad, there's absolutely, we don't feel a sense of living.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the nitty-gritty realities of everyday life for civilians in Iraq today, beyond the statistics and the headlines, and about exactly what it's like to have a foreign army and a host of militias fighting out on the streets of one's own neighborhood. My guests are Dr. Najib Hanoudi, an Iraqi ophthalmologist who's just arrived in the U.S., Sarah Sewell, who's at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and Christelle Yunus, an analyst and advocate for the nonprofit Refugees International. Najib Hanoudi, would you just quickly tell us about what happened to the Dora neighborhood where some of your own family lived and what kind of neighborhood it was before the war?
Jackie, I'm very glad you've asked this question, you see, but I'm going to answer it in a slightly larger context, you see. I'm going to talk about what happened to the Christians as a whole, you see, in this, during these last few years of what I call mayhem and agony.
Because you're Christian.
The Christians, mm-hmm. Yeah, the Christians have always been there in this part of the world for thousands of years. They were always law-abiding. And I'm not saying that because I am Christian myself, but because I am a rational and a logical, you know, a logical individual, and I am trying to project as a sincere and as a reasonable picture as I can.
I would just like to point out that you had many, many friends. Your best friend is Sunni. You have many Shiite colleagues. I mean, you never really thought about people's religion.
No, we never thought about people in those terms. We had friends from all sects, from all religions, all tiers of life in Iraq. The Christians were, as I was trying to say, were always law-abiding. They were doers. They were doing their jobs efficiently, nicely, in all areas, you see, in all areas of work. You see, the teachers were good teachers. The doctors were good doctors. What's amazing is that for one reason or another, they are now being targeted by both sides of the Islamic divide. They are being targeted nowadays by the by the Sunnis and the Shia sides, mm-hmm. with bombing of churches, kidnapping, rapes, shooting, and evictions. Dora is a suburb of Baghdad on the outskirts of Baghdad, almost the outskirts of Baghdad, in a southern, no, southern western, something like direction. It's opposite my Mansour house on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And this was mainly, there were a lot of Christians in there. Incidentally, in Iraq, during the last days of Saddam, there was about 700,000 Iraqis. And this figure is the only figure I can quote, because I quote that figure from the Archbishop of Baghdad, who is now being made a cardinal.
Well, and he has also, I believe, left the city and taken refuge in the north and in Dora. Have many people left? Did the Christian population
leave? In Ankawa.
Mm-hmm. As Christian suburb of Erbil.
Yeah, Cardinal Deli, his name is now. He is an excellent fellow. I think he deserved the red hat, but I wasn't able to congratulate him. Good heavens, what can one say? I mean, it's a terrifying problem.
Let's bring in Christelle Yunus, because I do want to stress this is one microcosm of a lot of the internal displacement, is it not, Christelle?
That's right. That's right.
Christelle
that's
Yunus?
Right. Yeah, yes, that's, certainly that's right. It is. And Najib is right. Christians have taken a very hard hit in this war, but so have so many others. And, you know, being Sunni in a Shia area has been equally difficult, being Shia in a Sunni area as well. And actually, when you look at the numbers of displaced, they kind of reflect the proportion of the sects inside Iraq. So in Syria, for instance, the majority are Shia. And then you have, of course, all the minorities like the Mandaeans, the Sabaeans, the Chaldeans that have been severely hit as well because they have nowhere to flee within Iraq.
I would like now to introduce to our listeners Michael Uash, who is project director for the Iraq Sustainable Democracy Project. He's joining us from Toronto. And Michael, you have worked among a lot of these minorities in the north of Iraq.
Hi, Jackie.
Hi, welcome to the show.
And yes, you're right. We've been working for about 3 years, and our project focuses on the situation of what we call Iraq's real minorities. The Assyrian, Chaldean, Syriacs, Mandean, Sabaeans, Turkmens, Shabaks, Yazidis. And we do see them as a microcosm, and the situation is extremely devastating. And if I can just pick up on something that came out between Christelle's comments and Dr. Hanoudi's, one of the situations about these minorities, for example, the Christian Chaldo-Assyrians, is that, yes, Sunnis and Shias and all Iraqis are facing violence. One of the differences, though, and this comes from our interviews with refugees in Amman, Damascus, and Beirut, in terms of the security situation, is that when there is a Sunni attack on a Shia neighborhood, there is the understanding that there is the potential for a reprisal. There is a deterrent factor. These groups have militias, have the capability to project force. Same with the Kurds. When it comes, what makes this distinct when we respond to this statement that there's a general state of violence is that minorities like Shabaks, Yazidis, Chaldo-Assyrians don't have a deterrent capacity. They are not a major political factor, and so the violence is purely pernicious, purely vicious. It's purely designed to send a message.
So, the minorities don't have militias.
They don't have anything really right now. I can tell you the best way to portray the picture of what's happened, for example, to the Christian Chaldo-Assyrians. They're called Chaldo-Assyrians politically. It's the Assyrian, Chaldean, Syriac Christians. By UNHCR's own numbers from their July assessment in the region, upwards of 25 to 30% of this people have become refugees. And if you take UNHCR's own reports, assessments, needs assessments in northern Iraq, where the vast majority of them moved to their ancestral lands, Dohuk governorate is the highest absorbing governorate. It's taking in 67% of all internally displaced persons.
And this is in the north of Iraq.
85% of them are Christian Chaldo-Assyrians. And UNHCR themselves are classifying them as a returning diaspora because, of course, these people are returning to lands that previous Iraqi governments Arabized them out of, mm-hmm. or ethnically cleansed them out of. So they were ethnically cleansed into the major urban centers from their ancestral lands. They are now being ethnically cleansed back to their lands.
And how is it going?
Not very well. You've heard, and your listeners have heard of the religious-based persecution that they're facing, and it is very real. The threats are, you convert, you send a daughter or sister to the local mosque to be married to a Muslim, you pay in order to fund the insurgency, and you've heard about the type of violence that they face. That's the religious-based targeting. In the North, unfortunately, they seem to be confronting, or they are confronting, a more ethnic or nationally driven type of persecution.
So I just want to point out the conversion sort of aspect that is sometimes forced, that you were speaking of a moment ago, sometimes goes on at gunpoint in Baghdad, but this has not been typical of their experience in the North.
Oh, no, no, and that's the distinction. As I said, in central Mosul and south areas, it's that religious type targeting.
Okay.
In the north, it's more an ethnic based targeting. So, for example, the community since 2005, one of their most formative experiences is that the dominant Kurdish political parties disenfranchised them, denied them the chance to vote.
Well, we do not have a Kurdish representative here to counter that, Michael, so I won't go there at this time. But obviously, it is still displacement. I mean, displacement, I guess, Christelle Yunus, displacement, can we say displacement is displacement? Wherever it is, does it matter?
Absolutely. Wherever it is, it's still displacement. The difference, of course, is that the people who are displaced outside the borders of their own countries are entitled to international protection. And usually they're entitled to certain principles, such as no refoulement. They're not supposed to be sent back to the country of origin until this is safe. Sadly, in the Middle East, this principle is not completely respected. Lebanon has been deporting Iraqis back to Iraq, so has Jordan. But in Iraq itself, the situation is becoming increasingly difficult because 11 of the 18 Iraqi governorates, the provinces of Iraq, have closed their internal borders to the displaced. So people can no longer even move inside the country for safer places because the safer areas are also completely overburdened and can no longer absorb the influx of the displaced. So in Iraq today, the situation is increasingly difficult because people want to flee but have nowhere left to go.
Okay.
They cannot cross an international border.
All right.
They cannot go to a safer place inside Iraq.
Okay, thank you. Let's take another phone call. Lewis is calling from Simsbury, Connecticut. Thanks for being with us, Lewis.
Thanks for taking my call.
And your question?
I had a question for the doctor. I have a little bit of experience with Iraq, I guess, because my brother fought in Iraq for about 3 years. He was in the army driving one of the Humvees looking for IEDs and such things. And also, I mean, even before the war, I knew an Iraqi man who was studying for his PhD. So I was just, from a humanitarian standpoint, the question that I wanted to ask is, what would, you know, the situation for just average people and the livelihood of people? I mean, I can just think of what it might be like for average Iraqis. I mean, all of a sudden the war is happening and, I mean, people start fighting. And then, you know, is there any way for people to get work? I mean, the marketplace, of course, electricity, water, I mean, just, you know, in terms of hope for the people, I mean...
A good question.
There any type of, and then the money, I mean, is there anything
right.
that people can do nowadays?
Thank you, Lewis. I think that is a question people always want to know. Najib Hanoudi, I mean, you left Iraq in February, Jordan in November. You talk to people every day who are still back there. What about that? What about daily life? Did you have to sell books or sell the car, leave the house?
I think that was a very good question from our friend there, you see, and it is very true. I mean, life in Baghdad, and I'm talking about my own experience when I was there for about a year, when I was doing the work to gain some money to help with the care for my son. It was like moving on a minefield, you see. You wouldn't know when something would happen. I had at least been involved in two incidents, you see, where things exploded a few meters from where I was going, you see, on two occasions. And I was saved on the two occasions. And on a third, more serious occasion, a car was, you know, exploded opposite the door of the clinic where I was working.
And you were taking three minibuses a day just to try to get to this job and living in a house with no electricity in the dark by yourself.
That's right.
At age 70 plus. Mm-hmm.
That was what's happening. And I'm saying that not to tell you how again, intelligent or clever or, suicidal person I am. I was forced to do that. I was forced, because of the necessity, to make a little money, you see, to help with the care of my son. I had to accept that sort of risk. And I accepted it. And I was, and I had two, three, very, very near deadly situations, you see. But I was lucky.
Lewis, does that answer your question?
Yeah, it sort of does. Personally, I think that in order to be able to make the situation a little bit better, we could do something to make it so that people have at least some type of livelihood, something that they can do that'll make them feel a little bit better and maybe give them some hope that they can rebuild and everything.
I mean,
just from my view.
Thank you, Lewis. Sarah Sewell, as you listen to this, I'm reminded of something that you wrote, that in some sense, while it was never perhaps declared, it always had to be a campaign for hearts and minds. I mean, from what you've been hearing today, I mean, can we say that this is in any sense succeeding on that level? I understand that General Petraeus places that at the forefront of everything he's doing, but he has an army of 170,000 people under him.
And he's inherited what we've learned from just this brief conversation today, a situation in which trust has really been shattered on the part of many Iraqi civilians. And there's an interesting connection now between the sectarian violence and the internal displacement and this notion of security. As our last caller just said, can't we give people a livelihood? Well, you have to have a secure environment to have that livelihood happen. And we see in Baghdad that the number of deaths, both of Americans and of Iraqi civilians, has declined dramatically in the last couple of months. That, to me, is an extraordinary change, and I think testament to the fact that General Petraeus has been able to inculcate a couple of key principles from what we've learned about the importance of winning hearts and minds, the notion that you have to send people out and about into the communities to become a part of their team, as it were, and to gather information so that you can be careful when you do use violence, the notion that you have to assume greater risk on the part of Americans in order to not be transferring that risk to civilians. We saw U.S. casualties spike initially with the surge, but this is a geographically and temporally constrained experiment. And in many ways, General Petraeus said it best when he said, this surge is to provide security, to provide a breathing space for Iraqis to take responsibility for their security, for Iraqis to solve political problems and to create a new political compact, for Iraqis to build the non-military elements of security. And we have yet to see that happen.
Well, let's spend our last minute. Najib, you have 1 minute. Has it worked? Do you have any hope? Will you ever return to Iraq? Do you think it'll ever be like it was?
Jackie, with all my respect, I mean, to our colleague here, Sarah, wasn't she? I can't accept all what she said. These kinds of wars are not solved by military, number one. What is being said now about a reduction in the casualties is only a matter of figures. They are saying that it has dwindled to 40%, which means something like 300-400 dead a month. Is that a good sign? Is that good thing to happen?
About the Iraqi political structure? Do you think there will ever be an Iraqi political solution? Because an American political solution is only half the equation.
Jackie, the Iraqi political structure, which has been created with the help of the Americans, which is running the country now, is a charade.
Subject for another On Point, and you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast. I want to thank very much my guest today, Dr. Najib Hanoudi, who spoke to us from Detroit, Sarah Sewell from Harvard, who's been in the studio with us, Christelle Yunus in Washington, and Michael Uash of the Iraq Sustainable Democracy Project. Fascinating conversation. Thank you all very, very much. You're listening to On Point from WBUR and National Public Radio.